Our guest tonight is an old friend, Gary Becker, who is one of the truly significant faculty members at the University of Chicago. There are many significant members of that faculty. He is, of course, a Nobel laureate in economics. But that's such a great distinction at the University of Chicago, is it?
Well, we have plenty of them.
You and I just went over the list before, and we found 16 faculty members who got the Nobel in economics.
Absolutely. And we'll have many more coming in the future. So,
I suppose.
So those who don't get it stand out more than those who did.
Working backwards in time, the first one from the University of Chicago to get it was one of the great founders of a particular school of economics, Friedrich von Hayek.
Yeah.
The Austrian school was represented there. And our good friend Milton Friedman got it only 2 years later in 1976.
Right.
And every two or three years, that happens. When is the Economics Prize going to be given this week? Or is it
Monday? Next week.
Monday.
It's coming Monday.
Have any idea who it's going to be?
No, I was discussing that with a few of my friends today. There are a number of very good people.
Could it be one of ours?
Could be.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't say who, but
right.
It could be. And I don't know anything, you know,
sure.
But it certainly could be.
Yeah. You got the Nobel in 1992. And here are some words from the citation by the Nobel Committee. They say you are given the award for, quote, having extended the domain of microeconomic analysis to a wide range of human interaction, including non-market behavior. Explain what that means.
Well, you know, what market behavior means, things that you go out and you buy in the marketplace, like a car, an orange, bread. There's sort of non-market behavior that I dealt with and others deal with was like crime. You know, you don't go out and buy and sell crime. The family, I worked on a family a great deal. Things like altruism, how many children people have, education, demand for education.
So in general, your so-called rational choice model of economic behavior reaches out to areas that economics conventionally or classically did not address.
Did not address, although one of the interesting and I think important changes going on in economics now is how many younger, particularly younger economists are working on those kind of problems and more extreme aspects of non-market behavior of all types. So initially that's true. It didn't address it. Economists dealt with, well, dollars and cents, if you will. But now what economists are doing is much beyond that.
I spoke to my good friend Sam Peltzman, a colleague of yours, just earlier today, and he got off a wonderful line, said, of your conception of economic man, he says, well, the model is utility-maximizing homo economicus. Utility-maximizing homo economicus. It flows beautifully from the tongue. What does it mean?
Well, what I would interpret it to mean is that people, and I'll put it in very simple, people try to do the best they can in the circumstances of their living. So if you take the marriage area, they try, you know, there's an important decision for people to make. It's not a trivial decision, and they're looking for a mate who's going to make them happier than a mate who might make them less happy. They don't always succeed, because there's a lot of uncertainty in this world, but that's what they're trying to do. Now, the only aspect of that statement I would disagree about is often homo economicus means a selfish individual.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, I think that's applicable for much of economic behavior, but certainly a lot of it we'd have to bring in things like altruism.
Yeah, well, if you're out to maximize utilities, one high utility, one high value may be the good you can do for others.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and
of course.
And I and others have stressed that in our work, particularly in the family, but elsewhere as well.
For the pathological character model conceived by the psychoanalysts and others, there is the sadomasochistic character. Can it be that for the masochist, maximum utility is the receipt not of pleasure, but of pain?
Well, it could be, although they would, to them, it might be giving them pleasure. That's why,
that's why
they're doing it, right?
That is
that's
the paradox.
A paradox, yeah. But yeah, they also are trying to improve their circumstances, but it may mean, you know, jumping off diving board where they may get injured or some other risky activity.
But now come back to marriage.
Yeah.
It's a good area in which we can test out the utility of this sort of rational model from economics as applied to broader areas of life. As you spoke of it just now, it sounded like what one would do if one were intelligent and properly motivated in seeking a mate. One would add up the assets and the liabilities, the positives and the negatives for a potential mate, and ultimately make one's decision. Maybe if there's a field of three or four candidates, you find the one where you get the most pluses and the fewest minuses. However, if one reflects back upon one's own life history or the life history of one's friends, you find that at least Westerners typically get married because they, quote, fell in love. And our very concept of falling in love assumes a certain non-rational or extra or beyond meta-rational investment in or flooding with emotion, which directs you sometimes in a way that seems almost mad, but you can't stop it. It is a compulsion from deep within your soul.
Yeah, I don't think rationality in, say, an area like marriage means you actually literally go through this type of calculation. I mean, you know, economic theory is a theory about how people behave. So, you know, we're trying to explain what people do. And I would never assume, and I never did, you know, you sit down and make a list on one side and the other side, and you make your decision. Although Benjamin Franklin, I think, talks about his making some decisions where he actually literally did that. But most people don't do that with respect to marriage. And people do, of course, particularly in Western society, modern societies. People don't marry unless they think they're in love.
But do their choices still, in a way, usually represent a maximization of possible utilities?
I think so, because if you look at, you know, the systematic aspects of marriage, look at who people marry. People of high education tend to marry people of other high education. People of one type of background tend to marry people of a similar background. People of one religion tend to marry people of a similar religion. By income, by age, you know, all these things are highly structured and are no different from what you find in a more traditional society in that regard, where love isn't considered that important.
You're an academic man, and I'm an academic man. They're not in economics. But inevitably, I will fall back upon the standard gambit for academic discourse. It always begins with yes, but. When you say people marry the same religion, well, yes, but. The data for American Jews these days, and for some years has been, that just about half of them marry non-Jews.
Yeah, because two things let me say about that. One, the smaller you are as a minority in a society, the harder it is, even if you would like to meet somebody of your same religion or your same height if you're a very tall person and so on. So you in trying to be make this decision that makes you happier, you're striking off a balance among various forces. Although we do know, and here's where rationality does kick in, that people who marry across races and across religions are far more likely to divorce than people marry within a race and religion. Although there are very many happy marriages, I mean, go on to stress for the audience out there of people who made this. But on the whole, the separation rates are much higher.
What accounts for that?
Well, I think, people of comparable backgrounds have more in common. And therefore, you have to have strong offsetting factors to be able to dominate that and be sufficiently powerful. And when you're getting married, marriage is a decision made with a lot of uncertainty, a lot of ignorance. You don't know what those factors are. And you find out that you don't have as much in common. And this one force that often keeps people in common isn't there.
I know that by virtue of the broad definition of the realm of economics that you've been working with and that you've helped to develop and to sell, really, to comparable academics around the world, that you've been very interested in psychology. Do you know the work of Fritz Heider? Is that name familiar to you?
A name is familiar, but I can't really say I know his work.
Heider developed a kind of simple model of interpersonal relations in which his basic concept is simply this: common valuation of some object of available reference for two persons. If they commonly value it, they tend then to come to value each other the more. And also, the more they value one another, the more they will work towards achieving common valuation. My favorite illustration of that is in the title of the novel so many years ago by Françoise Sagan, Aimez-vous Brahms? Do you love Brahms? Two people in the first stages of courtship test out, do you like this, do you like that? Do you like the music of Brahms? Yeah. And if you do, we're moving a little closer all the time.
No, absolutely. That's Perfectly consistent, and I'm glad to hear what you said with the notion that people tend to marry likes, so and tastes, So if you're an intellectual, if you marry somebody who has no intellectual interests, that often makes it very difficult to have a satisfactory marriage, particularly in the modern marriages, which are companionship marriages. It's not like in traditional societies, well, you married somebody, but you really had very little to do with other than reproduction and so on. Your friends, well, you say male or female,
Sure.
female friends.
But here's an anomaly within that same
Yeah.
context. How do you account for, again, another social fact, I think it's statistically verified, that people who've lived together in a cohabiting way for some number of years before marriage, and who then go on to get married, have higher ultimate divorce rates than those who did not cohabit?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You say it's a fact. I'm not so sure
Well,
it's
it's
a
often
fact.
quoted, I
Yeah,
gather.
I'm not sure it's a fact. I think we do know the following, that people who live together without being married for a given number of years are more likely to break up than people actually marry. And that's not so difficult to understand.
More likely to never get married, you mean?
To break up before getting
Yeah.
married. That's not so difficult because, they decide they don't want to make that commitment. That's part of the reason they're doing it. I don't think they have a higher breakup rate once they marry if than people who, say, were married for 6 years. Now you ask, are they going to break up in the seventh year compared to a couple who live together for 6 years, marry now, and ask if they're going to break up? I don't think that's true, actually.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. I've seen such claims, though I
Yeah,
haven't seen the
well,
hard data.
right. I don't think the data would support
We will be pausing every so
it.
often. As one of the world's leading economists, you well understand the necessity in this entrepreneurial undertaking for commercials.
I believe in
And
them.
here's a batch of them right now, and then directly back to Gary Becker. A famous definition of Gary Becker, as you well remember, of economics was given by Thomas Carlyle, the sort of dyspeptic English essayist in the first half of the 19th century, who simply calls economics the dismal science. What did he mean?
Well, I think he meant that economists in his day, and as you said, in the 19th century, were always stressing, so to speak, the limitations on what can be achieved. That if you try to help the poor, they'll just have more children, and they'll end up not being helped. So Malthusian population theory of that type. That economists took this negative view on life, not heroic view, but a practical view. And I think it was meant as a criticism of what economists did.
You took your first course in economics as an undergraduate at Princeton, is that right?
Right.
What year would that have been?
Well, my first course was around 1949 or so.
And how in those days did established professors of economics and the writers of economic textbooks define economics itself?
Well, there were a bunch of definitions, but typically the most famous one was economics deals with, the material side of life. That would be one very common one. Or that economics deals with men and women in the ordinary business of life. I would say those would be the most common definitions of what economists how economists define their field at that time.
And how in present-day textbooks or in the introductory courses given at the University of Chicago would economics now be defined?
Now it's much harder to define it that way because economists deal with so many
Because it's
other
spread out
issues.
so
Yeah,
much, yeah.
economists deal with issues of how people make choices on it when they have scarcity. When they have the, if you let's say you have a limited amount of time, are you going to watch television or read a book, or play with your computer? That's a choice issue. This is an issue economists deal with. Of course, if you have money, how are you going to spend your money? If you have a limited amount of energy, I like to play tennis. You're going to play two sets. How much energy are you going to expend in the first set when you know you'll have less left over in the second set? How do you pace yourself? That's an economic problem in part.
Looking over your stuff today, of course, I've been well aware of it in the past and I've read some of your work and we've talked about
Right.
some of your work on the program before. But it suddenly occurred to me to try to do a kind of rational choice analysis of some choices that I make virtually every day. And they are choices related to this radio program. Propositions come to us from publicity people and from the publicity offices of publishers, and books descend upon us in large number, and those authors are often offered to us as potential guests for this program. And I, together with my producer, Maggie Berndt, have to essentially decide, yes, let's do this one, let's pass on that one. Or we choose a topic without a traveling author, but then the question is, well, who do we get to discuss this matter on the radio program? So you're making choices and trying to review the utility of potential guests for the program all the time, keeping in mind what the program is supposed to be. Just this day, literally within the last 2 hours before you arrived tonight, Maggie came in and said to me, well, now, Dr. X, and he's a very well-known figure, mm-hmm. the head of a very well-known organization, we'll call it Organization Y, mm-hmm. We knew he's coming to town because he's giving a speech to yet another organization, and he himself, through his secretary, expressed an interest in coming on the program. Oh. Mm-hmm. And he's got views that are controversial concerning American foreign policy. Mm-hmm. So my thought was, since we've already recently done by telephone a program with him in which he was the solo guest mm-hmm. for just about mm-hmm. 1 hour, let's now find somebody somebody from the academic establishment or whatever who holds a different view of American foreign mm-hmm. policy. Let's have a serious debate. And I had a few such candidates in mind. The word came back when Maggie contacted his secretary at the institution where he is a very mm-hmm. important figure. The word came back, no, he will appear only alone, not with anybody else. Mm-hmm. And Maggie asked me, what do you want to do? And without going through a lengthy and troublesome calculus, I simply said, no, tell them, forget about it. And that was my decision. I don't know quite why or how I went through all of this, but it came rather routinely and easily.
Well, you were acting like we would describe a rational person would act in all the stages that you've mentioned. You look, you know, a book, which book should you have? Well, you're going to pick a book that's going to have a more provocative discussion, more interesting discussion. The audience would be more interested in it, right? These would be presumably the issues yeah. that would enter into it, that you could participate more actively in it. On this particular individual, you just already had him already. So what's the value added of having him alone again when you just had him alone?
That was my basic thought.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. So there would be some controversy. He, on his part, was probably behaving rationally. Maybe he thought he'd get beat up if he participated in a discussion. He wouldn't come out looking that great. So he may have declined for that reason. Maybe there are other reasons. But that would be the way, you know, in a common sense way, it would be consistent with what we say about rationality. So rationality, I think, is common sense put into a more systematic framework. That's sometimes the way I define what it consists of.
Here's another choice that I make routinely. Mm-hmm. I've been making it for years. I am, of course, by training and by my long mm-hmm. academic career, a psychologist, mm-hmm. a social psychologist, to be sure. There's all kinds of pop psychology which gets worked up into books. Sometimes it's halfway between silly pop psychology and serious attempts to do popular writing, but on the part of somebody with some academic or clinical credentials. When those books come to me, I almost routinely dismiss them without even any further thought, because pop psych is somehow anathema to me, and I just don't want to do it on this program.
Well, again, I would say that's a perfectly rational point of view.
It's a little prejudicial, I think.
Yeah, well, I'm going to add one qualification to what I was going to say. From your point of view, you're a professional psychologist, and it's kind of disturbing to see a lot of this loose garbage that may go under the heading of psychology. On the other hand, from the point of view of maybe audience interest and getting a discussion going and some controversy going, maybe it would be useful to have something like that on the program.
It probably would, yeah. I come back to your life story.
Yeah.
Would it be fair to say that you are Mark Rudd's gift to the University of Chicago?
Well, partly.
You'll need to explain that.
Yeah, people don't know who Mark Rudd was. Mark Rudd led the insurrection at Columbia during the student uprisings. I was a professor at Columbia at that time.
You had got your doctorate at Chicago.
At Chicago.
And then went back to Columbia.
Taught at Chicago for a couple of years, and then I decided I wanted to get away for a while. I went for actually a dozen years to Columbia. I was happy there most of the time, had a very good group. But then the student rebellion period came. I was unhappy the way it was handled by the faculty. I wasn't so much concerned about Mark Rudd. He was a student, youngster. It was my colleagues in the department and in the university that really bothered me a lot.
What went wrong with them? What did they do wrong?
I didn't think they took a tough enough stand against this attempt, really, to undermine what is the essential aspect of university, free inquiry without intimidation. And they tried to intimidate free inquiry. They tried to shut down the university. people who tried to have classes, they would come in and disrupt the classes. And that, to me, if you allow that, you're really ending what a university
is. In general, they were demanding a sort of a leftist totalitarian control over the curricular content of university life.
Absolutely, yeah.
Strangely, and that was very offensive to you, just as it was very offensive to Alan Bloom up the road a piece at Cornell at the same time.
Yes, I know.
And both of you came to Chicago on that basis.
He was a friend of mine.
But isn't it interesting, possibly bothersomely paradoxical, that in the long run, in a way, they dominated. Those kids on the barricades, many of them, went on to get their doctorates and entered into faculty life. Roger Kimball, years ago, wrote a book titled Tenured Radicals about them. And in large part, they have had a significant and lasting effect upon the curricular content of university life to this day.
I think they have. I think it's unfortunate in a lot of ways.
It's not a good outcome, is it?
I say, I think it's unfortunate in a lot of ways. I mean, some of the issues, and I mean, you know, what's sometimes called political correctness issues, which are particularly prominent at universities now, I think are a weakening of universities, diversity issues without enough emphasis on the quality of the candidates you're considering, but sort of trying to balance by groups of various forms, I think it is the opposite of what universities should stand for. And I think those influences have definitely become more important at universities.
We are again due for some commercials. After that, I want to turn to some of the other areas that you and your colleagues have investigated in the framework of rational choice theory.
Okay.
Some of the areas which arouse general public interest and general public concern. One of them, and you did a paper on this back in January of this year, is about natural catastrophe and recovery from natural catastrophe.
Yeah.
The paper was written before the Katrina mess down on the Gulf Coast, but it's very applicable and very relevant to our further thinking about just what we do now down there.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll turn to that, if we might,
good.
Directly after this. Our guest tonight is Gary Becker, university professor in the Departments of Economics, the Graduate School of Business, and the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago. He's also, and has for some years, been a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he was, of course, the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics in the year 1992. Also, many of our listeners will remember that he was, for some 15 or more years, a regular columnist in Business Week.
Absolutely.
Where you looked at the American economy,
yes.
And we're going to do that in a while, coming directly to the standard interests of economists. But let's go first to what you have to say, what you said in an article that preceded, by half a year, the disaster on the Gulf Coast, but really is focused on just such disasters.
Yeah. Well, you know, the world has gone through many disasters of all kinds, and there's been long interest in the question of how does a local economy or a broader economy recover? How quickly do they recover from disasters, and what does it take to recover from disasters? And my argument was twofold, that what's very important in recovering from disasters is the human capital of the people, their skills, their education, and so on. And there I'm echoing something that John Stuart Mill said 150 years ago, making basically the same point, that you recover quickly, the knowledge of the people is unimpaired. And so in modern disasters, that's typically the case. And secondly, disasters the recovery is surprisingly rapid. It immediately, it looks like, well, everything is devastated. You had earthquakes, for example, the Kobe earthquake in 1946 or so, 100,000 homes were destroyed, 300,000 people made homeless. Within a year, the employment was greater than it was before, the income of the area was greater than it was before, and so on. So typically, people and areas recover quickly from disasters, although what they are afterwards may not be the same as they were before. That is, the industries, they may change somewhat, the activities may change somewhat, but the recovery is quite rapid.
Now, from the available data, and with that model in mind, what is to be expected, what might be predicted, for that matter, what ought to be advised concerning the recovery of New Orleans?
Yeah. Well, New Orleans is an interesting question because, you know, should it be rebuilt in this in the form it was in, because it would remain vulnerable to another such catastrophe. My belief is that New Orleans, whether it should be or not, will be rebuilt and will prosper within a reasonably short period of time, that some of the people who lived there before may never return, but that other people will come in, and that it will continue to be what it was mainly. It was not a, it became a much less important port than it used to be. It was a major tourist center. I think it can continue to be a major tourist center. And I think the state and the city will recover pretty well.
But does it have that available large pool of human capital that is required?
I think it does. And the thing that one has to distinguish, the people who suffered the most were the people who didn't have that pool.
Yeah.
I think mainly people who were, I would say, so dependent on the government in many ways for their income through wealth or other ways, that when the government failed them, and there's no question the federal, state, and local governments all failed them, they really didn't know exactly what to do, and they got stuck, unfortunately, and suffered enormously. But the building up the city will not depend mainly or exclusively on this group, or they'll be part of it, but it will depend upon the people who anticipated the effects and moved out, and now will return in, the storekeepers, the university people, the professional people, and the like, who left but will come back, I think.
But that large underclass group, if one might use that word in quotes, most of them have had their housing literally destroyed. They don't have homes, however small and uncomfortable those homes were. They don't have those to return to.
No, but they'll be getting considerable assistance from the federal, mainly from the federal government. You know, we have a disaster for a number of years. We've had a program whereby if an area is declared a disaster, the federal government comes in, sometimes very generously, and will help. And I think in this particular area, given the very bad and disorganized response of all the governmental levels, there'll be a lot of resources that will flow into this area from the federal level.
By the way, can you shed any light on just why the response was so ill-coordinated and so ineffectual?
Well, Pose and I are going to write a blog this week on the on the federal, state, and local relations. So I'll think about it over that period. But my impression is, you know, governments aren't good in general are responding quickly to disasters. These other areas that I mentioned when you got recovery was mainly from the decentralized, spontaneous activities of many individuals. I would look at in the overall for New Orleans to recover, not because the government is going to be doing it, they'll be helping a certain segment of the population, but it's mainly the shopkeepers, the middle class, the professional people are going to come back, rebuild what they had from before. And that's going to be the backbone of the recovery. I think it's generally very difficult to rely on, particularly a federal government, to help you in a recovery period.
You've just mentioned the blog that you do together with Judge Richard Posner. Posner has been a guest on this program a number of times. Regular listeners certainly know that he's a distinguished federal jurist, as well as a continuing lecturer in the law school at the University of Chicago, and a very prolific author. But speak of the birth of the blog. How did that happen?
Well, as you mentioned, I had written this column for Business Week for 19 years or so, and that ended. And I was happy at this, because it was a long time to do it. But after a few months, I was getting a little restless, and Dick and I were talking, and we're kicking around various things, and we both said to each other, well, maybe, you know, there's this blog that's going on. Maybe we should try a blog together, since we run a seminar together. Our views are related, but not by any means identical in a lot of issues, so that we'd have enough controversy. And so then Dick contacted one of his former law clerks who knows all the technical details about starting it, and we just started it. And we worked out some ground rules, and we more or less have followed these ground rules, that we rotate who writes the initial column and who writes the response, and we post once a week, basically, and it's kind of grew from there.
It's a fascinating site, actually, and not only do you respond to each other, but you've got a very active commentary feature, and dozens and dozens of people pile in to write little mini essays in response to your essays.
Absolutely. We get a lot of commentary, pro and con, on what we do. We run typically well over 100, maybe 200 mm-hmm. Comments. And at the end of the week, we tend to post, saying separately, we post responses to the comments. And some of the comments are really extremely good. And we, as we say often, we wish, you know, we were wrong, or we wish we knew that beforehand. You get a lot of information blogs. It's a way of rapid transmission of knowledge.
The proper address is Becker-Posner-blog.com.
Becker-Posner-blog.com.
Yeah.
That's the address.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
It's increasingly quoted by all sorts of people, not only in the larger blog world, mm-hmm. but by journalists in print media.
Yeah, I think we've gotten surprisingly a fair amount of attention to what we say. You know, we deal with controversial issues. I think, you know, Dick is terrific at handling these issues. I make some contributions. So I think, you know, discussions that we give and what we elicit, I think has aroused a lot of attention.
One issue that you paid a lot of attention to, one general problem mm-hmm. area, is crime.
Right.
And sort of the rationality, one might say, of crime and of crime control.
Mm-hmm.
How does one get one's teeth into that from the point of view of rational choice theory?
I like to say, to provoke some of my colleagues, a criminal is making the choice in the same way as a professor makes their choices. That a criminal, you know, would think what's their alternatives if they weren't criminals. And for most, particularly when we deal with felonies, they're not very good for most of them. And then what's their likelihood of, you know, what could they do if they were stealing or engaging in drugs or whatever they may be? And what's the chance of being caught, and what would be the punishment? And they know these things pretty well, much better than you and I will know them, because that's their mm-hmm. business. Just like we know a lot more, you know a lot more about psychology, you know, I mean, about economics. They know about crime.
Or about faculty politics.
Yeah, you know, about faculty politics. So they know that pretty well. And I think on the whole, if you try to develop a theory of rational choice, that will mean what will deter them, being caught, being punished, having better legal opportunities, so better jobs available. Well, they say, well, it doesn't pay so much. Both sides, the carrot and the stick, would come out of the analysis that would have an effect on crime. Mm-hmm. I think that's been demonstrated in the last 20 years. The U.S., unlike Europe, has greatly reduced its crime rate, and partly through both means, but certainly an important means has been to increase the likelihood that people would be sent to prison. And so we have now over 2 million people in prison now.
What are we doing wrong from the point of view of this analysis?
I think what we're doing wrong is that the quality of education for maybe the bottom quarter of the population mm-hmm. is not good enough, and that we should be improving the quality of that education. I'm a big fan of greater competition, vouchers, and the like. And it's not it's not a magic wand that will make all kids from broken families and poor families all of a sudden, you know, be great students and so on. But I think we'll help a significant number, and that's what you really try to do with public policy.
How would you apply that to the state of competence or incompetence, of achievement or of failure, of the Chicago public school system?
Well, I would say a voucher system would be the best way to go, that allow students, students have their parents are given a certain amount of money that they can spend on any school, private as well as public, denominational schools as well as non-denominational schools, as long as they meet a certain curriculum basis. And that by introducing competition in this sector as well as in other sectors, I think you have a great positive effect. Let me just add one other thing.
Yeah.
It's not an accident. The higher education in the United States is the best in the world. And I think the single ingredient that defines that is the fact that we have so much competition among colleges and universities.
A very strong fact in this realm is that the Chicago Teachers Union and teachers unions in other urban centers mm-hmm. around the country stand united in strong opposition to the introduction of a voucher system, even in opposition to charter schools. What do you make of that?
Well, I think from a self-interest point of view, they're probably right, because they have more power when there's a single unit, namely the public school system, who's running all these schools rather than when it's decentralized. For example, teachers' unions aren't very strong in private schools. There are some of them, but not nearly as strong. They're really the powers in public schools. And they believe, and I think correctly so, that their power would go down. So it's a perfectly rational response on the part of the teachers' unions. Unfortunately, society, in my judgment, has to try to overcome that response.
It's a perfectly rational response serving their self-interest.
Self-interest, yeah. I'm not saying from a social point
not,
of view.
Not serving the general common
general
good.
Interest, yeah. Yeah.
Milton Friedman, who I know was your teacher originally,
mm-hmm.
was he not?
Mm-hmm.
And a close friend of yours and colleague.
Right.
And also, I think, the second member of our faculty to win the Nobel Prize
right.
in economics, is virtually the inventor of the voucher idea, isn't
Absolutely.
He?
Absolutely. He is the inventor of the idea.
Well, explain a little bit more about how that works.
Well, the way the voucher system would work would be that instead of the way the current system works, where if you're in a neighborhood, you basically go to the school in your neighborhood with some choice, and it'll be a public school unless you have the resources, you can send your child to a private school. Under a voucher system, let's say the government is spending, let's say, $8,000 per public school student. Suppose they took only a part of that, $5,000. They said to each parent, here, you can have $5,000 to spend on a school of your choice that would be your student would be, your child would be admitted to, and if the school would admit them, the school would have to meet a certain minimum academic standards, and then you'd have the choice. You can continue to send to the public school, and then they would get that $5,000 as resources, or you could send them to a new private school, an old private school, and they would get the money instead. That's how it would work. And the purpose of it is to bring in much more competition for the neighborhood school than we have.
And it's assumed that competition will also generate higher quality.
Well, it's assumed, but not just out of thin air. We know from the experience of virtually every other industry we know, including higher education. So including education, but higher education. The competition makes an enormous difference. As I said, higher education in the U.S. is outstanding on the whole, with all the defects that you and I know, mainly because of all the competition. It's not that Americans are better at higher education than the Europeans. We have a lot more competition than they do, and that's what makes
us. Because if the consumer has an expendable dollar to spend on whatever this product is that he's buying, in this case, the education of his children, if he has control over where his dollar goes, he will seek out the best quality.
He will seek out the best quality. And the school, the public schools, who are losing students, they will be under pressure to improve themselves. That's very important. You can see that at a university. University, if we're losing faculty in, let's say, my department to another university, we're under a lot of pressure. We say, we're doing something wrong. I mean, and that we try to improve. And I think people say, well, the public schools will get worse. I think the public schools will get better as a result of the voucher system because they will be subject to this pressure from competition.
I may be wrong in this, but it's my observation that one of the faculties you're on, namely the business school of the University of Chicago, sank a bit in the ratings, at least those U.S. News and World Report ratings, one or 2 years in a row. And the Kellogg School of Northwestern was shot up. And shortly after that, they developed the plan for a great new building, and they went, and that building stands there now, and it's attracting lots of people. I wonder if that's illustrative of the very point
Absolutely.
That you've been making.
These rankings, you know, there are a lot of erratic aspects of these rankings. They're certainly followed very closely by business schools, and by our business school, by Kellogg, and so on, by Wharton. And if you're sinking consistently, not just 1 year, but sinking consistently, that puts a lot of pressure on you to find out what are you doing wrong, and how can you improve it. And I think the new business school building, which is across the street from where I live, has been a great boom for the business school at Chicago.
We are going to pause shortly for a round of commercials and then, indeed, a brief newscast. And then we will return to Gary Becker. But in about 15 minutes, we'll be on to the phones. And now is as good a time as any to invite your calls. 591-7200 is, as ever, the number. 591-7200 for any question you want to raise or any argument you want to pose, if you've got the chutzpah to do that in dialogue with Gary Becker. 591-7200. If you're an internet listener and listening far away on either coast or in some other country and want to get through, the most efficient way is via email, the email address extension 720 @tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, or by phone 591-7200. We return directly after this. And we return to Gary Becker, professor of economics at the University of Chicago, Nobel laureate in that same discipline, and a very fertile mind which stretches in many, many directions, not merely as a matter of happenstance or self-indulgence, but really as a way of extending the applicability and relevance of economic analysis to many areas that conventionally were not considered to be within the purview of the economist. But one that is in the realm of conventional economics, I suppose, is welfare systems and what goes wrong with them. I think you will agree with me that Social Security is a problem not only in this country, but just about in all of Western Europe at the moment.
It's worse than most Western European countries, actually, than the United States.
What's gone wrong?
Well, I think what's gone wrong is the political economy aspects of Social Security. And let me stress two things in particular. One, that under pressure from the older people, country after country has lowered the retirement age, so made it easier for people to collect at younger ages Social Security. In Italy, they're collecting them in the 50s, typically. At the same time, people are living longer. So you're collecting them at a younger age, you're living longer, therefore the cost is going up from both ends. You're starting earlier and you're collecting it longer. So that's a major difficulty.
That combines with other welfare things. As, for example, in France, everybody gets a six-week vacation paid.
Paid, yeah.
Largely
absolutely.
Paid by the government.
Basically directly or indirectly paid for by the government. The second big problem in Social Security systems has been that their pay-as-you-go system, so that means people are taxed, the revenue goes into general revenue, not into some special fund, and then people who are retired get an income. Well, if the Social Security system is running a surplus, as the American system is currently, instead of separating that fund out and keeping it for the future when it's going to start running a deficit, it is being spent. So you're not accumulating any surplus to pay for in the future. The political temptation to spend what you collect is enormous in every single country, and it's here as well as Europe. And those are two of the major problems that Social Security systems has faced: aging population, earlier ages at which people collect security, and no ability to separate the collection that supposedly is to go for Social Security from other expenditures.
Now, the current administration has been pushing for some years. They finally seem to have stopped carrying on about it because they've got so many other problems directly on the table in front of them. But they've been pushing a privatization plan. You favor that?
I do. I think ultimately we're going to move in one way or another in that direction. And many countries, including some of the European countries, have begun a move in that direction. Countries like Sweden, it might surprise people, but it's partially moving that direction. Great Britain, of course, Chile, and a variety of other countries.
But our administration's argument has been, if you privatize, actually you'll get more return for the invested dollar.
Well, I think maybe you will, although I would put the emphasis on something else. The administration and many people said, well, if you privatize, people invest in equities, and you get stocks, and you get a higher return on stocks than you do on bonds, where the government sort of puts the money. But stocks are riskier, too, and so you got to compare that. I think the benefits of privatization are somewhat different, and I think they're very important, and they're related to what I said earlier, that people, once you privatize a Social Security plan, and people, that means people would save in their own account, and then when they retired, they would get the accumulated earnings on that account, including, you know, the interest and dividends and so on, and they'd be able to use that for their retirement age. Once you do that, people, I think, would retire later. They wouldn't be under this pressure to retire earlier because they're healthier now at older ages and so on. They would continue to work later. And secondly, the funds that are being accumulated would be separated from government funds, so the government couldn't be spending those funds. These would be in accounts of individuals that they would have under their name, like the way people have IRAs and so on. that a middle class of rich people can have these accounts. Social privatization, I think, would be a major benefit to the lower middle class and the poorer individuals who do not have IRAs or these accounts, who are mainly dependent on Social Security. And the prospects now for a young person are the money won't be there in 20 years or 30 years, whenever they're retiring, if we keep up with the present system.
You say they've made this choice in Sweden.
Partially. It's a partial element of it.
Has anyone else made this choice, and have we got enough evidence accumulated to show that it works better?
Well, the one country that went first to this system, really mainly promoted by some graduates of the University of Chicago, was Chile. 1981, I think, was when Chile started its system. So we have over 20 years of experience, which is pretty good. And I think what you find in the Chilean system is, one, on the whole, the return has been very good in the Chilean system. So people who accumulated these accounts did very well, as they, some of the people who, let's say, 35 then would be now 60, so they're approaching retirement age. They invested them in a mixture of bonds and stocks, so there's some regulation of that, but they had some portfolio that did pretty well. And so I would say they made the transition from the public system to, not entirely yet, but to a largely privatized system in Chile now. It is, but still there's a public element because it's still paying off some of the people who are under the old system. I think they made that transition very successfully. And so if you look at Chile, if we could do as well as Chile, that would be an enormously successful transitional process.
Down there, the leading economists were known for some years, are they still, as the Chicago Boys?
I think many of those who introduced major reforms in Social Security, privatizations of other industries, less regulation, were the Chicago Boys. And I think now they've gone through ups and downs, but now I think they're considered great heroes in Chile, certainly, and in some other countries, because the reforms have paid off. Chile is the most successful economic country in all of South America, in all of Latin America, basically.
One argument against taking academic life seriously is that academics are sort of irrelevant. They just influence one another, but they don't really affect the course of history or the flow of events, unless they're in the physical sciences, where they can invent things and change the technology. But it seems to me that's not generally true, and particularly illustrative of how untrue it is the history of your very department, the Department of Economics at the University of Chicago. Say something about the kinds of influence that has been exerted from our campus.
I think the influence has been enormous. It wasn't right away. It wasn't immediate. And some people sometimes say, well, you can't have an influence. You know, politics determine everything. And clearly politics are important. But a time comes often when there's the opportunity to make a change. Maybe the old system isn't working well. And then new ideas make a difference. Let me give you a few examples of new ideas that did make a difference. We already mentioned the privatization of Social Security. In Chile has now been replicated in maybe 25 countries in one form or another.
But we mentioned the voucher system.
The voucher system is another one. The privatization of the army, voluntary army, ideas that Chicago people in particular were pushing in the 50s. It took the Vietnam War to get it implemented. But once implemented, how many people in the United States now want to go back to the old draft system? A small minority. Some people are vocal, but a small minority. It's worked very well, I think, as a system. Deregulation, the deregulation of a variety of industries. A lot of it came out, not all of it, but a lot of it came out of the University of Chicago. And I can go on and on, that, you know, the role of competition as opposed to centralization, but a decentralized economic system. After World War II, many countries thought the wave of the future was the Soviet-style model of centralized control and centralized determination. And Chicago was a lonely voice. The Milton Friedmans, the Frederick Hayeks, the George Stiglitz, my teachers, I was lucky enough to have such people as teachers, were lonely voices at that time saying, if you follow that path, you're going to end up with a poor economy and maybe a non-democratic society. And I think experience showed that these economies, these highly centralized economies, did very badly. And we had the collapse of communism and so on. I think I would have to say that, in a way, University of Chicago economics played a role in that collapse.
A very significant role. And it had direct influence upon the politicians sooner or later.
Absolutely.
The kind of Republican Party position that first emerged clearly in the Barry Goldwater campaign was directly influenced by University of Chicago economists.
Definitely. Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, you could take three major figures who promoted this, were all influenced either directly or indirectly by the University of Chicago thinking.
And the key idea is revert wherever you can to an open market system.
Open market system, competition. If I had to say one word, I'd say it's competition. I mean, we mention it with vouchers, and we you can mention it in almost any area. Competition, if you have competition, you can do an awful lot of good, whether it's across countries, where the Chinese are producing goods, competing. I'd say that's good. Where we're producing, competing against them, that's good. Competition, free markets, that's the solution.
We will be going to the phones directly after another batch of commercials that is coming shortly. We've talked with Gary Becker about the application of his general economic model to the analysis of problems in education, in social security systems, in an examination of the nature of marriage, in the nature of crime and the possibilities for crime control, and for that matter, what we do to meet with disaster like the disaster recently encountered down on the Gulf Coast. For any questions you've got about any of those and yet other issues and other topics as viewed by Gary Becker, do give us a call. The lines are open and we're now ready for your calls, 591-7200. Whoever moves quickly and gets in first will be able to get to our guest tonight, 591-7200. And if you'd rather reach us via email, that email address is extension720@tribune.com. Whether by phone or by email, get your queries and comments in quickly, and we'll be with you directly after this. And we return directly to Gary Becker, professor of economics and of sociology in the at the University of Chicago, and of course, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, one of some 16 faculty members at the University of Chicago who have done so. And we go directly to the phones. Here is the first caller. Good evening.
Hi, Milt. I enjoy your show.
Thank you, sir.
And my question is related to Alan Greenspan and his departure next year. And I wanted to know Gary's thoughts. It sounds like, you know, that's an opportunity for, you know, paving the way of the future. So I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thanks.
All right, sir. We thank you.
Well, Alan Greenspan was probably the best chairman of the Fed U.S. has ever had, and therefore he presided over for a long period of time the economy through some difficult times, and he did an extremely good job of keeping the economy stable. It's going to be very difficult to replace him with a person who had equal skill as an economist, common sense, temperature of the economy, and so on. So it is a challenge. It's an opportunity, but it's more of a challenge, I think, than an opportunity. I don't know if we'll succeed.
That gives me occasion for the obligatory question, which I might well have asked earlier. How stands the American economy these days?
I think quite well, by almost, and despite the fact that we've been subject to many shocks of all types, you know, the oil price increase, the terrorism, the war, catastrophes of various types, and one can go on. If you look at how the economy has performed, you know, even post-Katrina and so on, what are the usual measures? How rapid has been the growth in income? Quite good. How is productivity done? You know, also how much are we getting from the labor and capital we use? Done very well. Inflation rising a little, but still pretty modest. Unemployment under 5% or so. Europeans would grab that tomorrow if they could get that. So by almost any statistic, the American economy has come through some very difficult periods extremely well.
What about the tremendous increase in deficit spending and the increased ownership of our bond issues by foreign governments?
Well, I mean, you know, those two partially independent issues. The main thing that concerns me about the deficit is that government spending has increased more rapidly than I would like, federal government spending. I mean, I can see the necessity due to the war and terrorism, but then in those periods, you should be cutting other forms of spending, during the first Bush administration, we did the opposite. We increased other forms of spending. I think that was a serious mistake, and I hope we can control that. Now, in terms of the ownership of bonds by the rest of the world, at low interest rates, it's not a bad deal. We're borrowing money at very low interest rates, a couple of percent, and people are holding it. I would say we're getting a good deal. When I was in China recently, and I spoke with the head of the central bank there, they were worrying whether they were getting such a good deal out of it. So I think from our point of view, if the money that we're borrowing is used well and successfully, privately or publicly, then you're borrowing funds cheaply, and you're using them effectively. And that's the real test.
Back to the phones. Here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I am one of your former students, going back about 48 years. And my question is, what is the status of monetarism today?
Well, money supply is still considered extremely important, of course, and Greenspan has followed that very closely, as well as other central banks have. The notion, however, that changes in the money supply are followed with some lagged effects on the real economy, that effect is much weaker than it was before. And people, it's not my specialty, but people like Milton Friedman would argue that's because the economy now has appreciated that effect and has adjusted to it much more rapidly than it did in the past. So in that sense, that aspect of monetarism is less important than it was before. But the role of monetary factors in, say, inflation, I think they're just as powerful as they were. They've been important for hundreds and thousands of years, I would say.
I got the impression when I was in your class, and as I said, it was 48 years ago, that you were never really very comfortable with monetarism. Was that an erroneous impression?
Yes, I would say it was an erroneous impression. I didn't talk about it much because it wasn't what I was teaching mainly, and it wasn't it. No, I was always perfectly comfortable with it. I don't think that's correct. And I certainly always were comfortable with the notion that if you increase the money supply enough and rapidly enough, you're going to get inflation. I mean, that's an old idea. It goes back to well before David Hume, but Hume was aware of it. And I think Milton Friedman is quoted as saying high inflation is everywhere a monetary phenomenon, and I think there are very few, if any, exceptions to that rule.
Sir, thank you for the call. And we'll go directly to another. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
I would like to know what Dr. Becker thinks about the proposed electricity auction for the state of Illinois. We've heard a lot about it, seen a lot about it in the newspapers lately.
Well, it's a good question. I'm not really familiar with the details of it, so let me answer it a little bit more generally. I think buying electricity in an auction is a good idea. You bring in competition, and the role of an auction is to be able to get things, sell things more at a higher price and buy things more cheaply than you would otherwise. And so in general, I would favor an auction. The details of the Illinois plan, I really am not familiar enough, and I really couldn't comment on them.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. We thank you, ma'am. And let's go to this caller. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. Dr. Becker, I'd like your opinion of the failed Amtrak system and the billions of dollars that have been lost through the years and whether it ought to be continued.
No, it shouldn't be continued. I think Amtrak, as you said, has continued to lose money. It's a quasi-governmentally operated system. I think it should be, the government should get out of it. And if we're incapable for economic reasons of having a viable passenger train system that goes long distances, then if private sector can't operate it, it shouldn't be operated. But I think it's been a terribly inefficiently run system, and mainly because the government has played such a role in it.
How could you do without railroads in a country like this one?
You wouldn't be doing it without all roads. You'd be cutting down a lot on maybe some of your long-distance railroads, and you can do without that very easily. For passenger service, See, the problem with Amtrak is a passenger service activity. You still have railroads running freight. Mm-hmm. You'd still have commuter lines and the like. Those would be no problem. But whether you need a train service going from New York to Chicago, New York to California, that's very unclear. If not enough people are willing to buy it, they can take a bus, they can take a plane, they could drive. There are many alternatives to it.
Are there comparable issues in relation to the failure, that is the bankruptcy, of most of the major air carriers?
Well, I think the problem with the air carriers has been that we haven't allowed two things. We haven't allowed them to, we haven't shut them down fast enough. We probably had excessive number of planes and so on. And, you know, they go into bankruptcy and they stay for a long time in bankruptcy. And I think the idea of bankruptcy was that, you know, you give a company a relatively short time to work out an agreement, and if they can't do it, you shut them down. That doesn't mean their planes won't be used, but they'll be go to other people, their slots will go to other people. And I think it's an unhealthy situation when you have four or five of your major airlines in bankruptcy and other airlines like American, you know, not making any money. There's something wrong there. And I think we should allow more mergers. We should allow more international mergers with domestic airlines. We stopped American Airlines from merging with BA. That was a mistake. And I think we've taken the wrong public policy issues with regard to the airlines.
We thank the caller, and we will pause for a quick round of commercials, then back to the phones and on to some email as well. There are now one or two phone lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, make another try and somebody will get through. 591-7200. And of course, the basic strategy is if you hit the busy signal, try again, especially after we say goodnight to some prior caller. For phones, 591-7200. For email, extension 720 at tribune.com. And back to the phones in just a moment. But first, let's take an email or two. This one. There's too much emphasis on macroeconomic factors in the mass media. Economic pundits tell us that the unemployment rate is under 6%, so we should feel good. But that number, like most macro numbers, is meaningless to most of us. Without job security, most workers need to keep starting over at the bottom. Without affordable retraining resources, there is no positive return on investment for advanced degrees for most workers. In the end, most workers can't achieve the tangible goal of prosperity, which is peace of mind. That's from a listener down in Kansas City.
Well, I don't really think it's true at all. I mean, the low unemployment rates that we have in the United States, markets where for most people, if you're laid off, you can find another job. That's where competition is very important, which differentiates the American market from, say, the French market or the German market, where if you can't find them very easily, means that the degree of insecurity is much less than it may seem on the surface. Secondly, we do know that people, the big trend in the United States and to some extent Europe has been not lower returns on your investment in education and training, but higher returns. So the advantage of being a college graduate now compared to a high school graduate is much larger than it was 20 or 30 or even 10 years ago. The advantage of training in a company is much greater than it was earlier on. So I think the trend has been the other way. More emphasis on the value of education in the economy, ability to move across positions in competitive labor markets, some insecurity. You can't have a perfectly secure system for everybody and still have a progressive economy. The Europeans have security for those with jobs, but they have 10% unemployment. People suffer enormously and are unemployed for long periods of time. U.S. has short-term unemployment, and that makes a big difference whether you're unemployed for a month or two rather than a year or two.
Gary, it occurs to me to ask you, of your many books, you've probably done about 10 or 12 books, which is, would you say, the most accessible to the common reader?
Well, the book I did with edited with my wife, Giti Nashat Becker, called The Economics of Life, which is a collection of popular essays that I wrote with an introduction by both of us. I would say that would be accessible to the common reader. Most of the others are technical, but I would suggest there are parts of two books that I would suggest. My book on human capital, which deals with the effect of education and training, parts of that would be accessible, and parts of the treatise on the family would be accessible.
The Economics of Life is published by whom?
McGraw-Hill.
McGraw-Hill. And we'll go directly back to the phones. 591-7200 is the number. You are the next caller. Good evening.
Yes. Recent economic Nobel Prize awards have been in behavioral economics. Do you have trouble with that, or do you find that the idea that there are sometimes some irrational decisions going on sometimes describes as anomalies of economic life? Can you just comment on that?
Yeah.
Before you do, define just what the realm or the area of behavioral economics comes down to. How does it differentiate from yours?
Well, it's not so easy to differentiate, because some people call me a behavioral economist, depending upon your definition of behavioral economics. One notion of behavioral economics is that you extend the range of objects of choice that people are interested in, that people are concerned about fairness, about altruism, about a lot of other things than simply selfish behavior. And that's something I've pushed my whole career, and I certainly, in that sense, I'm a behavioral economist. Another aspect of behavioral economics is, well, people don't behave rationally in some sense in a variety of circumstances. And that would be the aspect I think is worth addressing.
Whereas your model does stress, quote, rationality.
Rationality. Now, to me, I think, and I think some of the work in behavioral economics has been valuable and important. So, and I think it's been interesting. And there was one year only, but one year when the Nobel Prize went to two experimental economists. Kahneman, a psychologist, and Vernon Smith, an economist who, on most issues, Smith would agree with look at the world exactly the way I would look at it, pretty much. Now, but generally speaking, there's a difference between looking at things at a very, you know, microscopic level and looking at things at a market or a level. Economists develop theories to understand, for example, how do people respond to the high price of oil? A new bankruptcy law is going into effect. How are people going to be affected by that? And I think if you take those questions, economics does very well. So we are seeing now that that the high prices existed for a while, there's been a significant decline in the demand for SUVs. And now the latest report that just came out yesterday said that Ford and General Motors, which are heavily involved in producing SUVs, they've been doing bad before. They're doing even worse now because of the lower demand.
And they've announced they're going to make much smaller SUVs.
Yeah, they're going to try to make small SUVs, and they're going to shift maybe the focus.
Yeah.
While companies like Toyota that make hybrids and make more efficient fuel are doing extremely well. Now, that's a rational response, very simple one. Maybe not everybody made that response, but the market responded very well. Take the bankruptcy law, if I can make one second about that. The bankruptcy law hasn't been in effect yet. This shows anticipation. But people anticipating that it's going to be harder to go into bankruptcy when the new law goes into effect, the resources you can withhold from bankruptcy are going to be smaller. We have seen now a rise in bankruptcy in anticipation of the stiffer law. That's a rational response of a future event, quite rational, not by everybody, but by a significant number to make that a real phenomenon. So I would say that's what economists deal with. They're not asking whether Milt Rosenberg or Gary Becker is going to make this decision in this particular context, but whether when we have a force, a tax or a policy or something else, how does a group of individuals respond? And I think on that, economic theory comes through extremely well.
Mm-hmm. Sir?
Thank you very much.
We thank you for the
appreciate
call.
It. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we'll go quickly to another caller on 591-7200. Good evening.
Thank you very much, Professor. It's a privilege to speak with you.
Yeah.
You know, your use of the price mechanism has been of a great interest to me over the years, and you've applied it in your last response to the issue of, say, high gas prices. I wonder how you evaluate the efficiency and the value of those goods which are procured, or those services that are procured through government, which the state of Illinois, for instance, does not have to produce its services in accordance really with any sort of price mechanism. All that it has to do is worry about raising taxes. So you were able to say Amtrak has been a failed experiment and really ought to be shut down, and that's fair enough. My question is, what's your general theory for evaluating the efficacy of the delivery of governmental goods and services?
Well, it's a good question. It's a challenging question. The general criteria would be, you know, how much bang are you getting for the buck in terms of how much they're spending, how effective is the outcomes. My general view is that as much as possible, you want to take things out of the government sector and put them in the private sector. Now, and there are many things, like I mentioned Amtrak, I mentioned the vouchers where you bring in competition among private schools as well as public schools. You can go on, I mentioned Social Security to try to move toward a more privatized system, and you can go on and on. And so because I think on the whole government doesn't face, as you mentioned, the competition in most of its products, you try to put it in a context, a more private context, where it does face the competition. Now, you can't do that for everything. There obviously there are necessary and important government services, and what you try to do there is to provide what economists call a cost-benefit evaluation. You look at the cost of the government activity, whatever it may be, and you try to assess the benefits, often very difficult, but you try to assess the benefits, and you ask, are we getting enough benefits relative to what it costs? And because we're taking the money from the taxpayers, it's very easy for people in political positions to spend other people's money. I mean, we all find it easier to spend other people's money than it is to spend our own money. So you want to take a hard-headed view of how other people's money, that is namely the taxpayers' money, is being spent. So I would have a two-pronged attack. Put as many activities as possible into the private sector, and there are many more that we can do in that regard that we're not doing. And secondly, have a tough standard about evaluating whether we're getting enough benefits for the particular government activities that we have. And if not, then put pressure on for some reform.
Thank you so much for being on this program.
Thank you very much.
We thank you, sir, for the call. Indulge me just a bit. Reading some stuff about you, I learned that once you were attracted, as an undergraduate, I guess, to sociology, but you ran into the impenetrable prose of Talcott Parsons, and that persuaded you you'd better find something else to do, and so you turned to economics. But interestingly, you are now not only a professor of economics, but for some years have been also a professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. What's the connection between economics and sociology? Or what's been happening in sociology that reflects the sort of interest that people like you bring to it?
Yeah. Well, there is a school of sociology that believes in using rational choice along with social forces. So it's trying to modify it for sociology, but using rational choice and trying to understand a lot of social events. Our late colleague, James Coleman, who was a good friend of mine and probably of yours too, Mills.
His office was just two doors down the hall.
Oh, yeah. Was the leader. I would say he was the world's leader in doing that. And that's to the extent I work on sociological problems, and I do work some on them. That's what I try to do. I try to bring rational choice analysis in and combine it with social forces. So an individual may be affected by what, say, other people are doing, or by what sociologists call norms.
Mm-hmm.
How does that lead? What type of outcomes does that lead to? That's what rational choice tries to do within the sociological.
Can you give me an example of the application of that approach in a conventional? To a conventional sociological issue?
Well, let's take the issue of fads.
Uh-huh. You know,
sociologists deal a lot with fads.
Excellent, yes.
And how does one analyze fads? Well, Kevin Murphy and I have a book called Social Economics, where we have a chapter dealing with that question.
Mm-hmm.
And what we try to do is we assume that people are still maximizing, but they're influenced partly what other people are doing, but not by anybody else, that people want to be out in front of this activity. And so you have some people who are leaders and some people are followers, and the leaders start an activity, and because they get more utility out of doing it, eventually followers catch up with them, and then they have to search for another activity because there's no good doing something that everybody else is doing. And so they search for another activity. And so we show, as a result of that, and you have to consult the book for the details of this, you can get various cycles and shifts in fads over time.
Let me give you one that's just recently gone through a number of stages. Low-carb diets became suddenly very big. Right. And all kinds of food manufacturers started turning out low-carb versions. I understand that now it's almost completely disappeared, and in fact, there's a reaction against it. What sense does that make? Or how does one make sense out of that sort of commercial fad going through its full life cycle so quickly?
Well, the way I would analyze that fad, I think it has been a fad, was, you know, a lot of people want to lose weight. I mean, these were mainly people who wanted to lose weight. Now, if you could lose weight easily, it wouldn't be a problem for a lot of people. So it's a problem for a lot of people. And so people look for all sorts of ways to do it. They exercise a lot and so on. Somebody came along and argued, and with an appearance of evidence, that if you went on a low-carb diet, you can eat a lot, you can eat meat, you can eat bacon, and you can still lose weight.
That somebody was Dr. Atkins, who preached that for years.
Yeah, actually preached it for a long time. Yeah. He eventually caught on. His books became very popular.
Only after he died.
Yeah.
Actually.
Was it true? Okay, yeah. I don't know the details of that. And then, you know, some people did lose weight. And then that influenced other people to follow. Eventually, I think people discovered, well, maybe the weight loss didn't last that long. It wasn't a good cure. Maybe it had some side effects that weren't good, eating bacon all the time, for example, which was some of the thing. And I think, but it came in an area where it wasn't, people were searching for a way to do it. And they're still searching for ways. And there's still going to be more and more fads in the diet area until we come up with something that's well documented and well proven. And then it will no longer be a fad. This is a path that people will take.
I think the media play a role, particularly prominent personalities in the media who endorse something and kind of enthuse for it. And then when others are doing the same, they've got to find a new line.
Yeah, I think there's no question about it. You know, there are leaders. As I said, there are leaders and their followers. Yeah. Among the leaders are the media, right?
Quite so.
So if Milt Rosenberg on the show says something, that's going to have a big influence on what people do. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of influence the media has.
Well, it doesn't quite work that way with this program. But one thing that does happen regularly on this program is a round of commercials. A last one of those coming up, and then back to the phones on 591-7200. Our guest tonight for the full 2 hours has been Gary Becker, professor in the Department of Economics in the Graduate School of Business and in the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago. Nobel laureate in economics, that award having come in 1992. And we go back to the phones directly. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Milt. Longtime listener. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure, ma'am.
I was wondering what Mr. Becker thought, because I'm a little concerned about his ideas about school vouchers and privatizing Amtrak, because I see that as further marginalizing the disadvantaged if those ideas were to be instituted. And I was wondering what his thoughts on that were.
Well, explain, how does that marginalize the disadvantaged?
Well, if you institute school vouchers, and let's say everybody gets $5,000.
Yeah.
People with more money would be able to add to that to go to other schools. So then the people with less money would all be going to the public schools. And so they're still not getting the same quality of education, possibly. Not saying that the public schools aren't good, but I just think that it wouldn't be a fair playing field.
I think, am I right in this, Gary, that one way to process such a question is to look to some of the areas in which voucher systems have been at least experimentally attempted?
Well, and we use a voucher system in the medical area now where, you know, you're not told which Medicare, you have a choice of doctors you can use, and they just pay for it. But let me respond to that. I think it's just the opposite, if I may say, to the caller. I think my support of vouchers is because I think it mainly will help the poor. And my reasons are simple. If you ask who's getting the worst education in the United States now, Is it the rich or the poor? It's the poor. Mm-hmm. Why are they getting it? I think mainly because they're in the inner city or rural areas, but let's say the inner city, they have very little alternatives. The rich and the middle classes can move from community to community, and schools will be an important factor. The poor have very little alternative. And so by giving them the opportunity also to have choice, because they can choose among schools, including potentially private schools, but it could be good public schools, I think you do two things. You give competitive opportunities to the people who don't have it at present, which are the poor. And two, and people often neglect this, I think you're going to make the public schools better, not worse. They're going to be under more pressure to perform. And if they're not performing well, they're losing students. The boards and the principals will be fired, and they're going to get better. And I think one of the roles of competition is not only to allow people to buy from the good products, but it's also to make the weak producers better than they were otherwise.
Well, but if people who are living in poverty areas, schools are not good because of property taxes, because that's how schools are funded. The other thing is that how are these people who don't have a lot of money going to get their students to these schools that might not be in their neighborhood?
Well, it depends. I mean, I have some schools might be set up in their neighborhoods. You don't need a very big school to be a good school.
No, I agree.
You can have a school set up in the conjunction of different neighborhoods. We observe now when there is choice allowed, not necessarily vouchers because we don't have many vouchers, but choice allowed, poor parents who are interested in their children doing better are willing to have their children travel quite significant distances in order for them to get what they consider to be better education. And vouchers would take advantage of that great interest among many poor families, not all, but many poor families, in improving the quality of the education of their children, because they recognize the only way their children are going to get ahead is through education. They don't inherit money. They don't have a lot of the other advantages. But a good education would be one vehicle by which traditionally poor families have moved ahead through their children. I think that will happen in this case as well.
Ma'am, we thank you for the call.
Okay, thanks.
Very productive question indeed. Here's an interesting one-line question from a listener via email. Do you believe that a consumption tax, the fair tax, is workable? And if so, what are the chances of its happening?
I do certainly think it's workable. And the way I would think you would work a consumption tax is you would allow all savings to be deducted from income in preparing your taxes. So basically you end up only being taxed on consumption. A value-added tax on consumption would be one way to do it, but it's not the only way. You can say, let's say if I have a $30,000 worth of income and I'm saving $10,000, I would deduct that from my income and I'd be reporting for taxable purposes only $20,000, which is my consumption. So it's certainly workable in a lot of different ways. You know, when we exempt the amount you contribute to IRAs and other accounts from taxation until you take them out, that is in part a consumption tax. That's saying that type of savings is not going to be taxed. So it's certainly workable. Are we going to get it? I would hope we would, but I do not anticipate in the near future we are going to move to a consumption tax. I think there's still a lot of opposition to doing it. There's support and opposition. What I think we may move to is a modified version where we allow greater deductibility of different forms of savings from taxation. So we have something that's more closely approximating a consumption tax than what we have now. But a pure consumption tax, I think politically, we'll probably have to wait a while to get.
What wag was it who got off the line? If you laid all the economists in the world end to end, they wouldn't reach a conclusion.
I don't know who said it, but it's repeated a lot.
Is it true?
No. No. Actually, economists agree on a lot of things, but the disagreements are the ones that you enter into public policy discussions. So, for example, if you take a consumption tax, you'll find a majority of economists, particularly the ones who work in public finance, who would support something like a consumption tax, because otherwise we're double taxing the income that you get, and then we tax it against after, once you save and invest it, and that's inefficient. You find a lot of economists doing it. So on the issues you agree on, it is not much worth talking about in public policy. So the controversies occur in the many areas where there is, you know, there is still considerable disagreement. We don't know. There are a lot of things we don't know a lot about in economics. But there is certainly on a lot of basic issues, like on what would be the effect of a high price of oil that I mentioned earlier and some of these other examples, 99% of the economists would give the kind of answer I just gave earlier on that.